more government entity creates an office of equity, I will scream at the top of my voice. Because, you know, the arrogance of assuming that you can open an office, put a sign on it, hire one staff person, and then say, okay, hundreds of years of inequity will now be solved because I hired this person for $45,000 a year and they're going to fix it. The sheer arrogance of that. And so we have so much work to do in this community, but how wonderful we're at a space and time that I think there's a lot of people trying to figure it out. I mean, the fact that Kay Boo is having conversations around race and racial equity and, you know, and people are showing up and actually digging deep into it, that means that we are actually at a place where change is not only possible, but is actually happening. Other questions? Yes, ma'am. I love you too, and thank you for coming just for me. That was very special.
The next questioner asked, what is the best way to reach people as individuals in the community who may not know about racial and social justice issues?
I think that's absolutely right. So here's what I normally like tell white, well-meaning people who just don't have a clue about racial justice and how to get started. I normally send them to a website, and the website is called SURGE. It stands for Standing Up for Racial Justice. The website was created right after Trayvon Martin was killed. It was created by a group of white middle-class folks who were just so disgusted with Trayvon Martin's death. They thought, okay, today I'm going to start having conversations with white people about race. I sent them to that website because it's one of those websites that it says if you have 1 hour to give for racial justice, they give you a whole list of things that you can do. It's S-U-R-J is how it's spelled. Standing Up for Racial Justice is what it stands for. If you want to give a week to working on racial justice, it gives you a whole lot of things you can do. It gives you responses to people, white, well-meaning people who say, well, but he must have been doing something because otherwise, why would the police shoot him? It gives you ways to respond to those people in a way that actually creates more dialogue and conversation. And so I start there. If I'm in an audience where I think people like will get better information by reading, I encourage them to go read Michelle Alexander's. Thank you. The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. Then once they've read that book, I say there's a companion book to that, because now that you've read it, you have to do something with the information, and there's a companion book that's developing a campaign to end the New Jim Crow that just came out last year. And so, and in fact, as part of the NAACP, we have a religious services committee, and the gentleman who chairs that committee came up with a whole list of like reading material so that you can relate it back to faith-based communities, right? So if you want to read about, how do you want to read about faith and race, I've got a whole bunch of books that you could read. And then last but not least, I always tell well-meaning white people that don't know what to do that they should join the NAACP Portland branch because I'm the president and we need you. Yes, and that is why I wanted to put that out there. You're absolutely right. There's so many misperceptions about the NAACP that it's an organization just for black people. In fact, the Portland branch is 101 years old this year. And on those days that I go home and I pull the covers up and go, who in their right mind would take on this volunteer job again? Right? When I pull the covers up, I start thinking, what must it have been like 101 years ago when a small group of white, middle-class Oregonians and a few black Oregonians came together and decided, we need an NAACP in Portland, right? And so I have to believe that nothing I face today would be bigger than what they faced 101 years ago when they started this organization. So that's what gives me strength to continue to move forward. Other questions? Got a question, ma'am? Yes, ma'am.
An audience member asked Joanne Hardesty to talk about the Coalition for a Livable Future.
Well, I have a sad story to tell you about the Coalition for a Livable Future. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore. But I worked with that organization for quite a few years, and the goal was to ensure that as the region prospered and grew, that we all would equitably benefit from that growth. The Coalition for Livable Future some years ago started mapping inequity in our community. And so, as you know, when you have limited resources and you go to your government seeking redress and you say, well, you know, black people aren't able to buy homes in this community, they always tell you, well, you need statistical data, right? It's like what you see with your own eyes isn't sufficient. You need some researchers to go and check it out, put it on paper. And so that's how the Coalition for a Livable Future was born, because organizations who didn't have a lot of resources didn't have the time, energy to actually develop that data. And so the Coalition for a Livable Future did that. And that material then became material that grassroots communities could use when they went to the city council, they went to the county commissioner, they went to the state seeking redress. And so it did a wonderful, wonderful job. And was it still needed? Absolutely. But as with most nonprofits, funders' attention shift, and they weren't able to actually sustain themselves long term. But what came out of that is now a national equity mapping process that is taking place, so that the model that was developed isn't lost, but it's being used around the country to create these maps to show what happens in local communities. Yeah, it was one of my favorite organizations, but unfortunately, they're gone. Other questions? Yes.
A member of the audience said, you mentioned earlier about having a video for people who are transplanted from somewhere else. I moved here a year ago, and I'm interested in what you would put in that video.
What would I put in the video? So you have been here for a year, so you're a long-timer, huh? Just kidding. What I would put in that video, see, I'm not the creative type. Like, I'm not like this guy. Like, I'm not really creative. But I think what I would do is, like, flash moments in history, right? Like, I got to tell you, it's really hard for me to go into inner northeast Portland nowadays. When I first moved here, I lived in inner northeast Portland on Northeast 15th, a couple of blocks from Fremont, right? And it was a working class neighborhood when I lived there and had a house there. And it was an area where, when I first moved here, the media messages I got is, whatever you do, don't go to Northeast Portland, right? It's overrun with gang members, right? So, of course, I moved here, got an apartment in Northeast Portland, got a job in Northeast Portland, started, you know, walked around the neighborhood constantly, loved my neighborhood. But when I moved in, I started hearing about the divide, right? That there was like this invisible line on Fremont. And so if you lived below 14th, right, it was like the black area of town. And if you lived above 15th, it was like the white area of town, right? So who knew? I moved on 15th. I didn't know I was living on the white side of town, but hey. But what was interesting about that time was there was a lot of police presence in that community, right? And so didn't have a lot of infrastructure, weren't a lot of supports for people who lived in that community, but you could get the police to show up pretty much anytime anything was going on, right? And so you fast forward now almost 30 years, and now that same neighborhood where all you could get were police service, and I have to laugh because people actually drink on the street now, right? When I lived in that neighborhood, If anybody drank on the street, you knew the police were coming. They were going to carry you away. No questions asked, right? But nowadays, apparently, they have a last Thursday event where, you know, white middle-class folks just drink alcohol all up and down the street, and there's a big party, and you know, and everybody's happy, right? New Orleans, right, on steroids. Now... it breaks my heart to go to that neighborhood, and it breaks my heart for many reasons. For one, the condos that are going up right across from the New Seasons on Williams, they start at $750,000. They start at $750,000, right? And so that's shocking to me. But what's more shocking is the unwelcoming feel when I'm walking down the street in North Williams Avenue. Now, and I live there where you would never see a white person after dark on Mississippi, on Williams, on Alberta, none of those streets ever, right? It just didn't happen. They'd come in for the barbecue during the day, but they'd be gone by the time the sun went down, right? And so if I was developing that video, I would have snippets of the history of Portland, right? Not enough to tell the whole story, but just little snippets. And it wouldn't have to be more than 10 minutes long, right? But what it would do would be to show the changes that happen in a community so quickly. In fact, Portland has a history of replacing the black community every 20 years, right? It is part of our public policy processes, and that's just how we roll in Portland, right? And it's like, and if you look at the history, so if you go to the old City Club report from back in the late 1960s, you'll see that there used to be a thriving African-American community downtown, right? And then they were displaced, right? And then there was another thriving African-American community, and then Vanport flooded, right? Then Emmanuel had a vision about building out some stuff, and then there were African-American homeowners who disappeared because Emmanuel had a vision. Then there was I-5, and then there was another African-American community that disappeared because there was an I-5. And so it is historically consistent that every 20 years, the African-American population is displaced, right? But we live in a city with progressive leadership, right? So, you know, so how is that possible? That doesn't happen in progressive Portland, right? And so I would want people to know that those big, shiny, mirrored buildings that are all going up, somebody was displaced for that building to be there. Right? And I would want them to know the stories of those families who were forcibly displaced so that they could live in their $750,000 condo. Right? I mean, I'd like to have a car, but they're not even putting in carports in there, right? It's like, but I guess if you can afford a $750,000 condo, you don't need a car. Maybe you have a driver or something. Yeah, a helicopter, heliport on the top. That's right. Other questions? This is fun. Yes, ma'am.
The questioner asked Joanne to comment on the commission that is supposed to oversee the Portland police.
I know a little thing. I know a little bit about that. And so, yes, so I know. See, they know me so well. So the short version, the Community Oversight Advisory Board is the body that was put in place to oversee Portland Police Bureau's Department of Justice settlement agreement. You may have heard that the Department of Justice has done their first analysis about whether or not Portland Police really are doing the reforms that they, in fact, are supposed to be involved in. And the first report was pretty scathing, I may say, because what the report showed is what I had been saying to the city council ever since Mike Reese was the police chief. How are you going to believe what Mike Reese says? He's the only one looking at the data. You may remember Mike Reese kept telling us they were 85% done, right? He had a pretty PowerPoint color-coded presentation that he would take everywhere. We're 85% done with reforms. You don't have to worry. We're almost done. Well, by the time the Department of Justice was able to review what they said they've done, what they point out is they still... reports to describe what happened on the scene when all the police officers there are now supposed to write those reports. We still find that use of force is increasing, especially with people with mental health issues or people perceived to have mental health issues. We still are waiting to find out what happens to a police officer who actually blatantly lies in court, like it happened with Ty Grew, the 17-year-old North Portland youth who was charged with attempted murder, who was facing 30 years in jail because two police officers in North Portland told a narrative of him attempting to murder them. So when that case went to court, because the community took video, the judge reviewed the community's video, and lo and behold, the two police officers' story, and I quote the judge, was not credible or believable based on the evidence she reviewed. And so, but those two police officers still are in uniform, are still working every day, and there has been no discipline as of yet, right? So in this new improved Portland Police Bureau with Department of Justice oversight, not a whole lot has changed. And so it is my hope, and the Community Oversight Advisory Board, they need us to continue to put pressure on them, to put pressure on the system to actually make the changes that are necessary. And we are footing the bill for the changes not working. And when I listen to this lady talk about Portland police having resources to get people off the street, I believe they are so far out of their lane that it is pathetic, right? I don't understand how the Department of Justice, with a straight face, could say that Portland police should be first responders for people with mental health illness at the same time that they found them being abusive and egregiously wrong in how they interacted with people with mental health issues, right? And so I thought, how about firefighters, right? How about mental health professionals, right? Why are we building mental health system inside the police bureau when that is the last place someone with mental health issues should ever have to interact, right? And so the flaw of their solution to what they found is enormous. And I think until we, the people, start putting pressure on the police to say, we actually don't want police to go out and check on people with mental health issues. We want mental health professionals, for example, to be the people that go and do that. Crazy, right? I know, right? I mean, that's a radical thought, right? Yes, ma'am.
An audience member said she had served on the Police Review Commission and said she believed the real culprit in preventing police reform was the police union.
Can I disagree with you? It is certainly not the police union. It is a lack of political leadership to demand the changes that absolutely have to take place.
The audience member repeated her point about the problem with the police union and asked what we as citizens can do to address this problem.
Well, I mean, I've been, for the last three contract talks, I've gone and sat in the room and listen to them debate the contracts. And let me be clear, our political leadership hides behind the police union, right? The union does just what it's supposed to do. A union's job is to protect its members, period, right? I expect that of the police union, I expect that of any other union, I expect that of the teachers union, any other union, right? It is our weak political leadership that allows the police union to continue to do what they do. Great example I will give you. The last time the contract was up for renewal, one of the questions that's been on the table for a decade is this 48-hour rule that the police use to not talk after they shoot or injure a community member, right? It's called the 48-hour rule. Now, as I've looked at police union contracts all over the country, no other police department has a rule that says you cannot ask questions of an officer for 48 hours. We've seen it play out in this community. After Kendra James was killed, we saw the police officers meet at a community restaurant so that they could talk and get their story together before they had to file an official report, right? And so the last contract talks, now we still had Mike Reese as police chief, we had Charlie Hales as police commissioner. Last time they negotiated the contract, the AMA, Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, which I'm a part of, sent a letter to the mayor and said, this is our bottom line for your negotiation. You got to get rid of the 48-hour rule. You got to get drug testing in place. You got to be able to hold police accountable when they do egregious things on the street. This is our bottom line. 3 months later, Mayor Charlie Hales calls us in for a meeting. The contract is done. We've negotiated as hard as we possibly can. They bring in a whole room full of lawyers because, right, they can't talk unless they have a whole lot of lawyers behind them. And they start giving us the song and dance about the new contract. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm waiting. Because I'm just waiting to hear about the 48-hour rule, right? And they get to the end of their, this is what we were able to really negotiate. And I didn't hear anything about the 48-hour rule. So as I'm prone to do, first thing I said was, what about the 48-hour rule? And the mayor looks at me and says, and I quote, well, they would have never given that up. And I went, you mean you didn't ask? You didn't even ask? It wasn't even on the table? I was absolutely floored at his lack of leadership, right? And so he would be the first one to come out and say, well, we can't do this because the union won't allow us. And if we allow our weak political leadership to get away with that story, then shame on us. Because the reality is, if he showed leadership, I mean, it was a great time to do away with the 48-hour rule. The DOJ had just investigated him. The DOJ had just found him guilty of beating up on community members. If you can't ask to get away with the 48-hour rule, then when can you? Right? And so don't let anybody get away with telling you it's the union. Unions do what they're supposed to do. They protect their members. I will never, ever be angry with a union member for standing up for their union. That's what their job is, right? But when you have a boss who is supposed to represent our best interests, and they go into the negotiations, and they don't bring up the number one issue that the community's been complaining about for a decade, something's wrong with that. And that's what happened there, yes.
An audience member said, it's time to make the unions take out liability insurance on this behavior.
Well, even before you go there, how about just taking it out of their budget, right? I mean, I would start with just taking it out of their budget, right? If the jury awards $2 million, that comes out of the police bureau budget, and now they have to learn how to live with $2 million less. Unlike what we do today, which is they overspend their budget every single year, and then they go back and they ask for more money, right? The DOJ has been a money cow for Portland Police Bureau, right? You can't go through a week without them being at city council saying, oh, we got to do this because the DOJ said we got to do it, right? And it's BS. I can't tell you how many times I've been there and saying, actually, if you read the settlement agreement, it doesn't say the police do this. It says the community does that. But they're at the city council for more money just about every week. And so, you know, we got to fix that. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you here today. Is there one last question before I sit? Oh. You know, I would be rich if I had a nickel for every time someone's asked me that question. Let me tell you, I am not planning to run for public office in the next year. However, I am committed to working with a small group of community volunteers to look for people that we believe will better represent the majority of the people in this community. So I won't be a candidate, but I will be coming back telling you people who I think deserve a shot at serving on the city council, because let me be clear, and I know it's KBOO and it's a non-political and we don't do political endorsements, but my own personal opinion is it is time for radical change on the Portland City Council. And because there are three seats up, we have the ability to not only take over the city council, but to beat the two that are left in the shape that they will do whatever we want them to do to hold on to their seats. And that's just me personally, not KBOO. And so, if I might, there are two things I want to tell you about that are coming up that it would be wonderful to have your support and have you be involved. One, on October 8th at the Hollywood Theater at 7 p.m., there's going to be a special screening of the Black Panthers, Vanguards of the Revolution. It's going to screen at 7 p.m. October 8th. It will be a benefit for the NAACP Portland branch. The Hollywood Theater is donating 100% of their proceeds to the NAACP. Yes, yes, I think that that's very, very cool. And then the other night I heard about this other documentary called Holler, which is H-O-L-L-A, Holler, that's gonna be at the Hollywood Theater on October 18th. Holler is about a girls basketball team in East Portland that was started because this young man who moved in and out of Portland kept starting boys basketball teams to help boys develop self-esteem, et cetera, et cetera. And these girls begged him. They said, we need a team. We need something like this. And so this documentary was developed here locally, and it's a local story about these girls and this basketball team. Both of these are going to be phenomenal documentaries, and I hope that you will join me at both of them. And this one is not a fundraiser for the NAACP, but I think it's going to be a phenomenal story. I saw a trailer for it, and I just think it would be wonderful to be able to support these young girls and this phenomenal documentary filmmaker. So thank you very much. Hope you I'll see you all there. And I'll leave these here.
That was Joanne Hardesty speaking at KBOO's annual meeting on Sunday, September 27th at PSU's Native American Student and Community Center. This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:56 a.m. Coming up in just a few minutes, we have an extended edition of Flashpoints as Air Cascadia takes the day off. This will be a rebroadcast of yesterday evening's Flashpoints that comes to us from KPFA in Berkeley, California. And we thank KPFA and Pacifica Radio for sharing that with us. And we thank you, KBOO members, for helping fund that, help defray the cost of that sharing. Maintaining regional solidarity with our siblings in struggle in the San Francisco Bay Area. After that, at 11 on Intersections Radio, host Sarika Mehta looks at walkable communities and social justice, health privacy, and we'll hear an important story about deaf South Asian Americans. That's right. If you missed KBOO's membership drive a couple weeks back, you don't worry, you can still become a member of the KBOO Foundation at kboo.fm. Click where it says donate today. Now, all that and more is coming up in just a little bit. Right now, let's just relax and groove.
Purdue Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the opening of Mommy, an exhibit at Yale Union, Saturday, October 10th at 4 p.m. Mommy is a group exhibition featuring work by Lutz Bacher, Sonia Hamilton, Diane Simpson, and more, including a performance by Corinne Schneider. The show opens October 10th at 4 p.m. and will be up through December 20th. Again, that's Mommy at the Yale Union, 800 Southeast 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present A Hard Day's Night as part of the KBOO at the Clinton Monthly Film Series. The Beatles made this film in 1964 as they portray a rock and roll band traveling from Liverpool to London for a television broadcast, and wackiness ensues. Again, that's A Hard Day's Night, Thursday, October 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.